You're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of pinball.
Shoot for the captive ball.
Mark, today we're talking about the Twilight Zone.
All right.
Hopefully you picked that up from the intro there.
I just thought you were trying out something new.
No, that's the famous introduction to the Twilight Zone.
Oh, really? Rod Serling's a big pinball guy.
No, that's the introduction to the television show, The Twilight Zone.
He says pinball? You're entering a world of pinball?
I think so. I haven't seen an episode in a long time, but I'm pretty sure that's how it goes. A little bit of Twilight Zone trivia for you here, though.
All right.
What's another kind of phrase you maybe associate with Rod Serling on The Twilight Zone?
I mean, the only one I could really think of is picture, if you will.
A picture, if you will. Yeah, that's good. In that same vein, the one that always comes to my mind is submitted for your approval.
Ah, yes.
Turns out that only happens in three episodes. It's just like, for whatever reason, like
just memed.
It's one of those things, yeah, that just came up. But
that was a pretty good Rod Serling, I think.
Thank you. Yeah, I've been practicing. So I mean,
secret is you're just like have to pretend you're hiding, like you're holding in a bunch of nicotine smoke, like cigarette smoke, as you're trying to talk. So you're very tight-lipped.
Yeah, I think that's probably a big part of it. I'll confess that, like, I think probably greater than 75 to 90% of my Twilight Zone knowledge is not from actually seeing episodes, but just like greater pop culture. I've only seen maybe like a handful of episodes.
Yeah, I think a lot of mine actually comes from, do you remember in the 90s they made a Twilight Zone film and it was like sort of vignettes, like just different Twilight Zone stories but told in a film. So there was...
Was it from like classic episodes? Or?
Uh-huh. So they, okay. Well, at least one classic episode, because they did there's something on the wing, and the guy from... I think the dad in Beethoven, I think is the frantic passenger who sees like the gremlin on the wing. And then they also, the only other one I remember from that movie is called, I think it's called Kick the Can. And it's about a bunch of retirees like living in like a retirement home. They go to play Kick the Can and it like literally makes them youthful again. Like they become children. And that's...
Do they end up continuing to play until they're like...
Funny enough, I don't remember how it ends other than I think of the different vignettes, it's like the most uplifting of them. So I don't recall it ending in
then
any
probably,
kind of...
Probably they don't like go back to...
No, I don't think they just like die. But on the other hand, like maybe that's like a metaphor for like them going out on their own terms and or something.
That's uplifting. Yeah, I guess, you know, at some point it's almost like it's self-correcting sort of curse because... You're going to lose the ability to kick at some point if you keep...
That's right. Yeah, you can only go so far.
And then you'll kind of grow back up into a kicking age again and then maybe question when.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway, like let's talk about some famous Twilight Zone episodes. What is kind of like the most famous one that stands out for you?
Well, so Something on the Wing is definitely up there.
I think that's probably number 1.
But the other one that always comes up for me, and I think you see it online referenced all the time, is like the guy who just wants to read, like be left alone and read a book and like the end of the world happens or something and then
let's
glasses
talk about
break.
That. I want to talk about this one. It's called Time Enough at Last. And to give a quick kind of overview of what happens, there's this kind of...
Picture, if you will.
This banker, he's working and he likes to read books. There's a banker who's like a teller at a bank. That was before the days of, you know, online banking. They had people that would... do your transactions
for
you.
That's insane.
I know, it's crazy, right? Like, that's this whole story.
It's like, just a world where bankers exist.
Yeah, like, you didn't have, like, a credit card. You had to go and, like, talk to a
person. There were no ATMs.
It's wild, yeah. And then just, like, goes to the credits. No, so there's a banker, and he's just obsessed with reading. He's, like, reading at work, and he gets really, like, annoyed when people are coming up to, like, ask him questions.
Yeah.
And, like, apparently, you know, he's always reading at home and his wife's always getting after him. And then the next day, you know, he's going to the bank, taking a break. And he goes, you know, as you do, into a secure concrete vault to read a book during his break.
It was the Cold War.
Yeah, sure.
So,
I mean, just like statistically, that's where you should be most of the time. It's,
yep.
It's kind of crazy that people...
Most accidents happen outside of the bunker.
Yeah. So he goes into the vault and apparently like seals himself in there for like just a few minutes to like get some peace and quiet. And, you know, it's kind of fitting that last week we were talking about total nuclear annihilation, because that's what happens.
Someone shut down all the reactors.
different kind of nuclear annihilation, I think a bomb, right? And that's the big scare that everybody had, I think, for decades in the Cold War.
Yeah, right.
You never know.
Right. That's probably why he's reading his book in his bunker.
Maybe, yeah. He's reading the book.
Never be too cautious.
In the bank vault.
And then
he comes out and, yeah, like you said, everything is just destroyed. Everything's destroyed. And
except for his book collection.
Well, and that's the thing, is that he gets very, like, depressed and despondent, and he's thinking, like, is it, you know, life is not worth living now, it's just terrible. And just as he's ready to end it all, he comes across the, like, ruins of a library, or maybe just like a book collection somewhere. I'm
okay.
Not sure. And he realizes, oh my gosh, like, these books survived the blast. And then you alluded to this already, but he goes to great pains to organize these books into, like, the order in which he's going to read them, because he's, like, planning out basically the rest of his life to read books. And he goes to pick up the first book to read, and his glasses fall off his head.
That's not fair. That's not fair at all. There was time now. There was all the time I needed.
Irony at its finest.
The best laid plans of mice and men and Henry Bemis, the small man in the glasses who wanted nothing but time. Henry Bemis, now just part of a smashed landscape. Just a piece of the rubble. Just a fragment of what a man has deeded to himself.
Indeed.
In the Twilight Zone. Anyway, that's the summary of the episode. I think it's great. Great episode.
Yeah, it sticks with me.
The trivia question for you here, we only see, I think, maybe like one of the books that he's actually trying to read when he's like at the counter before. What is he reading? I'll even give you an author if you want.
Yeah, give me an author, because there's
Dickens. It's Dickens.
Great Expectations?
It's not. It's David Copperfield. So, and not the magic one. Not the magic.
Yeah.
Yeah, just kind of an interesting little bit of trivia. Not particularly, I think, relevant to the theme of the story, but it's kind of a interesting little bit.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's interesting because, you know, every year, I don't know if you catch this, I think it's around Thanksgiving, Sci-Fi or somebody puts on Twilight Zone for like 24 hours straight. Maybe it's Christmas. It's one of the holidays. And from time to time, I'll catch probably the same, I think, three or four episodes. It's just my luck, I think. That's my Twilight Zone experience.
I mean, the show is on for 5 years, so it's not like...
Oh, it's not...
Not like it's been on for, you know, a
super
long, long
deep
time.
Catalog, I guess. But it's not like Rod Serling was ever cryptic in what message he's trying to relay.
No, it's usually pretty clear. Not a lot of room for interpretation.
Yeah, I think of one of the other famous ones, and I don't know if you've seen it, is The Monsters Are Due at Maple Street.
I am not familiar.
It's been a while since I've seen it, but the crux is like there's this small neighborhood on Maple Street, and aliens or something have come and invaded, I don't know, a house or a neighbor. And basically what happens is paranoia and jealousy overtake the neighborhood, and this once loving community falls into shambles because they all start hating each other and standing against each other. And it's just the Red Scare of the episode. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's
yeah.
just about...
Not necessarily come with bombs and explosions and fallout. There are weapons that are simply thoughts, attitudes, prejudices, to be found only in the minds of men. For the record, prejudices can kill, and suspicion can destroy. And a thoughtless, frightened search for a scapegoat has a fallout all of its own. For the children, and the children yet unborn. And the pity of it is that these things cannot be confined to the Twilight Zone.
I think it's great that they had those lessons back then, but that's surely not relevant to like us today.
No, I mean, we've learned those lessons.
Yeah, I think, yeah, we've moved past that as a society.
Hang the banner on the aircraft carrier, mission accomplished.
Oh. Well, that's really interesting. That's very, very different than the book episode that we just talked about.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, one of the interesting things about The Twilight Zone as, you know, an anthology, is that there's just so many different stories being told that are not related.
Dare I say a modern Aesop's Fables.
Yeah, that's a fair comparison, I think. It's really interesting that they're all kind of their own self-contained little stories.
Yeah.
And that makes it kind of an interesting challenge, I would say, to adapt that brand to something like a pinball machine.
That's
like,
true.
What do you do?
That's true. And because, you know, things that stand out to me as like memorable episodes are not necessarily going to be the same standouts for everybody else. So how do you pick the catalog to resonate with the largest audience you can?
Well, if there is anyone who was up to that challenge, it is the designer of the Twilight Zone pinball machine, Pat Lawler, who designed this one in 1993.
Long time friend of the show,
Pat Lawler. And listeners will remember that Pat Lawler has made not one but two previous appearances on the podcast. He designed the Addams Family and Willy Wonka.
Oh, okay. So 90s era, I think Twilight Zone that's a similar era of the Addams Family, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But Willy Wonka, so Pat Lawler's been around a while. He's been around a while.
And with the Addams Family and Twilight Zone, maybe the designer of like the two most prolific pinball machines of all time, or maybe just the 90s, I'm not sure, but there were 15,235 of these produced.
Wow, that's many.
Yeah, I think that they're all over the place. A lot of them. Yeah. So it was obviously commercially successful. I saw a bunch of, charts from when the machine first came out describing, you know, how players would replay and play longer for the Twilight Zone than any other machine, and how if you're an operator, this is the one that's going to get you all the quarters. And that's something I've talked about in the past, how a lot of pinball machines seem just designed to be sort of like quarter separation devices, you know, and just pull as many quarters as you can.
Yeah.
But Pat Lawler, I think, has a way of doing it, at least with Addams Family, in kind of a unique, fun way that you don't feel bad about it.
Yeah, I recall, and I thought this way too, I think, when we reviewed Willy Wonka, like the categorization I've put Pat Lawler in is tough but fair. Like it's a challenging shot, but I don't feel like I'm getting ripped off or like something that is so unachievable. Like he may not be designing with me in mind, right, as like an amateurist, but like it's nothing that I've ever felt in his designs like absolutely brutal.
Yeah, and that's a hard thing to design for. So let's talk a little bit about the Twilight Zone machine before we go and play it.
Great.
It's got a lot on it. A lot of decals, a lot of toys, a lot of tie-ins to episodes that I don't understand. But like in general, your goal is to kind of build up some shots and eventually unlock the ability to fight the power.
Okay, and is that a Twilight Zone thing?
As far as I can tell, it's not. I think we saw the power once previously, though.
Yes, the Addams Family, I think I called out specifically that the game design references the power not as a thing that you battle, but as like there's a magnet under board, like sort of near, if you remember where the Fester scoop was on the Addams Family in the lower center, there is a magnet under there that occasionally could activate and whip your ball in any particular direction. And I think that mechanism was called the power. So if this game is, does this game come out after the
Addams
Family?
Yeah, this is 1 year after Addams Family.
So I wonder then maybe if Pat Lawler really was taken with this design idea and wanted to take it to the next level and now the power is like an antagonist that you can engage with directly.
Yeah, he designed the power for the Addams Family, realized that it was too powerful, and now designed a whole pinball machine to defeat the power. I like this Pat Lawler cinematic universe we're coming up with.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, so tell me about what is the power like in the Twilight Zone?
So the power is this kind of nebulous enemy that you're fighting, but it does also involve magnets, because in order to battle the power, you've got to get up to an upper play field.
Okay.
There's a specific shot to hit to get up there, but you can't always have access to it. You got to unlock access to the upper play field through hitting other shots.
Cool.
But once you get up there, you're going to battle the power by kind of bashing the ball against certain targets,
okay,
which normally you would do with a flipper.
Yeah, right? Some mini flippers or something,
right?
Sure.
That's what you'd think, but in this case, there are magnets up there that are like magnetic fake flippers. They're magnetic flippers, essentially.
Oh, so
it's
not like...
You hit the left and right to make it a magnet on either left or right side, like bash.
Okay, so it's not like there are flippers and magnets are derailing my shot. My flippers are now magnets.
Yeah, and you control them importantly. You control when they're on. And so that's kind of like the unique thing is that we've seen magnets a few times before, Adam's Family or Black Knight.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times it's something that like captures the ball with or without your control. In this case, you're turning on and off these magnets and trying to time it so that you hit targets to defeat the power.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, so that's probably like the most interesting thing to do. Other than that, like you're able to send balls up into a pinball, or excuse me, not a pinball machine, a gumball machine.
Okay.
Yeah, and I had to look this up because I thought, is there like a famous Twilight Zone episode about gumballs? No.
No, just
a fun thing that Pat Lawler thought he wanted to put in. So there's like,
does it dispense like actual gumballs?
I never got it too. Maybe I didn't put enough quarters in, but it has little gumballs in it, and it has pinballs in it if you put them in there.
Okay.
So that's something to look out for.
So you have seen this before?
Yes, that's right. I have seen it before, but we'll have to look out for that when we go play it.
Okay.
Gumball machine. The other kind of unique, interesting thing from this machine is that it has six balls in it. Five of them are traditional steel pinballs,
mm-hmm.
and one of them is like a ceramic white ball that is not affected by magnets.
Also not a gumball.
We could try and chew it. Let's try it. We'll try and chew it.
All right. Got to get it out of the machine somehow.
Yeah.
We'll figure it out.
You gotta hit that ball pretty hard, I think, to get it to come out of the machine and try. But that's like a unique thing.
That's neat. Do you know what the purpose of that is?
I guess just that it's not affected by magnets, and therefore they can detect when that ball is out and sort of change the game. You know, there's this concept of like a power ball.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure what that does, though.
Okay.
So we'll check out the power ball, see what happens. Any other questions or about the machine before we go check it out?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, let's enter the Twilight Zone. All right, welcome back. We've just played the Twilight Zone. And this, you know, like a lot of machines, is one that I have played before because growing up in the 90s, you couldn't avoid this machine. It was one of those, like the Addams Family, that was everywhere. But this, I think, is the first time that I've really sat down and, like, understood what I was doing. What did you think?
It's goofy. Like, there's something unique about it. Like, I think I don't know if it's just all the mechanisms or, like, the toys or whatever, but, like, it feels very much its own thing. And I don't know that I've ever encountered that before.
Yeah, it's its own thing in spite of the fact that it's branded as a Twilight Zone pinball machine. You know, we talked about this before, but like a lot of the things on the playfield are call-outs or tie-ins to an episode.
Yeah.
But some of it just isn't. Like the gumball machine is just like kind of a fun thing that, you know, they came up with. And same with the power.
Right? Yeah.
It does feel like its own.
But both of those, as I think you pointed out before we left, like the gumball machine sort of evokes like some Twilight Zone, like memory, like some Mandela effect in you or something where you're like, yeah, there's got to be. I remember something with a gumball machine.
I wonder if it's just like from the era, you know, like, I don't know, maybe it's just like a Pavlovian response, see a gumball machine, put quarters into something. Right?
Yeah. Like, anyways, it's that and the power both felt like they fit, you know, aesthetically into the Twilight Zone, even though they don't. So like, it's interesting. Like I found it very unique overall.
Yeah. Overall, I liked it. I appreciated it. I thought that it holds up in spite of the fact that it's a 30-year-old, you know, pinball machine.
Oh, that's math I didn't want to do.
Yeah. Right. So yeah, not exactly a new machine, but I do feel like it holds up.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think like we usually do, we want to talk about kind of three categories of like just how we think about the pinball machine. We want to think about the design, and that can be, you know, playfield design or game rule design, something in that sort of area. The theme, how well does the machine sort of capture the theme of the pinball machine? And just generally, how fun is this machine to play? And that's sort of a catch-all for maybe anything we didn't capture in the first couple of categories. So I guess just to get that started, I'll talk a little bit about the design of the machine. I really liked how there were a lot of interesting mechanics on this playfield that mm-hmm. were unique to the machine and certainly unique at the time that it came out. It could have been just like revolutionary, right? Like there, we talked about the ceramic ball. I thought that was kind of neat. The magnetic flippers, that was pretty cool. As like, as a playfield design, that shot to get up into the upper playfield. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember, but there was like a little like mechanism that it would kind of catch the ball for a second. And then depending on whether you were allowed in the playfield, it either let you through,
yep,
or it would kind of like dump you down back onto the playfield again. Yeah. And I thought that was so cool because like you could have done that, I think, much cheaper.
Yeah.
You know, with just like a little, you know, one way kind of flip toggle thing that, yep, would just like push you down or whatever. But instead they went to the pains to like design this custom mechanism.
Yeah, like
to
a kind claw of like almost that would just like
kind of drop you back down. And yeah, that was just so cool. So lots of cool stuff in the design of the machine. One thing that I thought was really going to affect me that ended up not was there are these kind of two ramps at the top that are the gum and ball ramps.
Yep.
Like, mm-hmm, you're supposed to spell out gum ball to, you know, start a multi-ball or whatever.
Yeah.
And I thought those things are too close. Like it's going to be impossible to figure out which one to hit. It's going to like get in the way all the time. It actually ended up being okay. So like even though these two ramps I thought were like really tight, I thought it worked out. And I was able to kind of like pick and choose my ramp as appropriate and maybe it was just
the luck
of the draw.
I mean, I agree with you on all points. And to that end, I feel like it's cramming a lot of usability into your standard kind of small space that is a pinball area. And that space is even smaller when you consider that they added that upper playfield area for the power battle mechanism. And so like it's clever designs in how they fit it all in there.
It's really hard to do, I think. And a lot of times pinball machines that try and cram in a lot of targets and shots, they pay for it by making those shots like impossible to hit. Like you're always bricking them. You're always hitting like something else.
Yeah, and I think
it's like a giant spider.
Oh yeah, he was on the wall earlier.
All right. Hey, buddy.
It's a daddy long legs though, so we're chilling. We big chilling.
All right.
We'll edit that part out. I also thought that it incorporates a lot of those standard elements that you see in pinball machines. Two ramps, some orbits, some big targets to go for, pop bumpers, stuff like that. But the layout of them does feel pretty unique to me. So,
sure,
you know, the pop bumpers are on the left side under like where that power battle area is. And I think just the way they cram like you said, the gum and the ball ramps by sort of side by side, even though one goes left, one goes right, is sort of, I don't know, like a zestier kind of implementation of some of the standard features you've come to expect of pinball machines of the time.
Yeah, I think given the tightness of all of the features on the playfield, it really could have been a lot more chaotic. You could have had a lot of times when the ball kind of like got out of control or went somewhere it wasn't supposed to. But I don't think I ever really felt like that. I don't feel like any sort of rebounding ball came back, you know, down the middle without in an uncontrollable way. Like a lot of thought went into it.
Yeah. And by the way, that is like, I think almost an exact note I had for one of Pat Lawler's other machines. Like when we played the Addams Family, I felt that that was like a note that I've kind of taken as like almost to be a hallmark of him now, where like the shots can be challenging, but they don't immediately brick you when like you fail the shot.
Yeah, and so I think that's kudos for that. I think Pat.
Yeah. I think Pat Lawler continues to be one of the designers that I appreciate the most, even though I think his designs continue to be for caliber of players that are better than me.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But like, this is definitely one you could see where you'd want to put in a lot of time and get.
Yeah,
get
I think good the at it, the, right? the growth curve is attainable. It doesn't just like ramp up immediately. The last design note that I had on my end is I want to talk a bit about the skill shot because I thought that was also a pretty unique design to Twilight Zone compared to other machines. Specifically the fact that normally if you just launch a ball into a play field, it's going to go out into like the back area somewhere and loop around. In this one, if you hit a full charge shot, it's going into a scoop. And then it's immediately going to come out of like the main scoop in the play field that you try to hit and unlock like it's like a slot machine that starts different modes or whatever. Yeah. So if you hit like a full strength shot, it just goes into the scoop, pops back out to you in the lower playfield. So it doesn't even do this like loop around the playfield. And I think that in itself, you've seen more of in recent machines, but is fairly unique by itself.
I think it's not common, and it probably wasn't common in 1983.
Yeah, and I think there's something ethereal, I think, about doing that. Like, your trance, like, it's almost like a magic trick, right? It goes into a scoop and then, like, oh, magic, it comes out of the other scoop.
Yeah, and let's talk a little about these whatever, super skill shot or whatever, because like you said, you normally will hit it into a scoop, but...
Yeah, right. So then I don't think I think it's just the normal skill shot then at that point, because like if you hit full power,
it's not really a skill shot.
Yeah. So if you hit it light so that it does not roll into that scoop, the ball rolls back like it's going to go down back to the plunger, but then there's like a one-way gate that it's passed through at a certain point, and that one-way gate slides the ball almost over to like the main playfield scoop, and then it'll drop into a secret scoop that launches the ball all the way. There's like a rocket ship on the playfield design. And so it rockets over towards what I'll call the hitchhiker area, and where the pop bumpers are on the left side to grant you kind of your skill shot. And I think that's, I don't know, again, that's kind of a cool design because it feels a little hidden. It feels like it's rare that skill shots are about like just enough power to barely get the ball out onto the playfield.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I really like skill shots that are about kind of finesse rather than getting lucky with timing on some, you know, target up at the top or something that like you don't feel like you have as much control over. But I felt like the skill shot was something I could practice and get better at. I think I hit it probably half the time, but like it was really easy to just give it a little bit too much power and it just went through the regular scoop. So a satisfying skill shot and a good payoff, I think.
Yep.
It was really good.
And the actual last note that I have then on the design is that the upper flippers, I feel like a lot of games they use upper flippers, and I'm not talking about the power, which because those are magnet flippers and those don't really count. There are two upper flippers still in the playfield. One is like super stubby and short, and it's right below, you talked about that rail that has the claw that kind of drops the ball in. It drops it in right by this upper tiny, tiny flipper that you can then use to reliably hit over into the upper right playfield area. And there's like a ball lock up there. There's like a robot mode that you hit up there. And then on the right side, there's also like kind of a mid-level playfield upper flipper. And in a lot of pinball machines, I feel like the upper flippers are sort of afterthoughts, or they're for like impossible shots that are designed for expert players to really leverage. And I felt like the introduction of these here was well placed enough where I felt like they were more helpful than hurtful when I tried to use them.
Yeah, great placement of the flippers. And I think a lot of that just speaks to the overall design of the shots and targets, that they were useful and not punishing if you didn't hit. You know, and that's a hard thing to get.
Yeah, right? Agreed.
So what was your score for the design of the Twilight Zone?
I gave it 4 out of 5. I really, really enjoyed the design. I thought it was unique. It would, honestly, I could probably be convinced to put it out of 5. I think there's just a lot of cool stuff going for it that I really, really liked.
Yeah, I also gave it 4 out of 5. I had one note that is one thing that I never quite figured out. There was sometimes on the right when the ball was going kind of behind, like near that rocket ship in that like back area,
yeah,
the Twilight Zone music would play and it would I almost felt like it was holding the ball there sometimes for a second to like line up with the music, but sometimes it wasn't. And like, it was really confusing to me that like the ball wasn't coming out as fast as I expected it to.
Yeah. I wonder a little bit if that was the machine we played, because I had a few times battled the power and then the magnets turned off. And then instead what should happen, the ball should settle in this like little small play area, and then there's a drop where you would normally drain a ball down the center. But for whatever reason, the ball would land in the bottom right corner, and I would have to get a tilt to get the ball to actually drain. Like, ball search wouldn't do it. And I wondered if a little bit, if that just means because the machine is tilted on the left, on the horizontal axis, in a little bit too much to the right, that maybe that impacted what you're thinking of there.
Yeah, very, very well could have. And I think really overall, it's just that like a lot of times when I play these great machines, and I had a great time playing it, I get maybe even more like, I don't know, strict about any little ticky-tack thing that I can find because I don't want to give, you know, perfect score.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the baseball, like, journalists who never want to make a first ballot Hall of Famer because Babe Ruth never made it on his first ballot.
Yeah, so I think really not a lot bad to say about this machine design-wise. I really think it does just so much right, and I gave it a 4, but like you said, could be convinced to give it a 5.
I think for me the biggest knock was the power battle thing just... It's a cool idea, but the execution of it doesn't really work for me.
I mean, be honest, though. Are you just saying that because you didn't defeat the power?
Well, I mean, obviously. But, like, a little bit because I felt like the magnet zones – and maybe it's just because it's such a unique gimmick that I don't have enough experience with – where I should be engaging the magnet, like, because you hit the flipper buttons to engage the magnet. Yeah. And my timing on that is poor, and I think it is poor, but, like, I don't know, it doesn't work for me in a way that.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, just for
posterity, we get it. You beat the power.
I did defeat the power.
Yeah, we get it.
But I did feel what you were saying that, like,
I was just kind of mashing. Like, I was just like...
Right. I didn't feel in particular control. And I think maybe one part of it is that there was not, like, a visual or even audible kind of cue.
Oh, you know, that would be kind
of
neat.
Of when the magnets were active versus when they aren't. And maybe that's, like, a physical limitation of that kind of electromagnet that, like, it takes, a half a second to warm up. Or I don't know.
How do
magnets work?
No one knows. It would be kind of interesting, I think, to... have like an LED or something. Like if you push the flipper, maybe it like a drop of water, right? Like it pulses out from the center, so you could see how the magnet, how the magnet should be propelling. Like a visual indicator would have gone a long way for me to understand what I was doing.
Just like a visual indicator of what's supposed to happen, but I also would like a visual indicator of like timing, you know, relative to when you turn on the flipper.
Yeah, I think if I push the flipper, I would like to see like that like little pulse of like what that force should look like to the ball.
Okay. Well, so minor notes.
Get Pat Lawler on the phone.
Yeah, I think we have him booked for next week, so we'll get him on one of these days. But all right, let's move on to the theme. Like we've mentioned this a couple times, but there were just so many references to the Twilight Zone that are completely lost on me because I just didn't grow up with the show. I don't know it all. I knew some of them, but like a lot, they were pretty cool. But, like, kind of a lot to take in.
Yeah, definitely agreed. And I felt like I knew that the monsters are due at Maple Street were there. The pop bumpers, all the cars honking, I think is a reference to that. I recognized the reference to when you get the extra ball, it says, like, the Talking Tina, I think, grants you the extra ball.
Oh, yeah.
And so I recognized some of that. But a lot of it, yeah, sort of indistinguishable. And I think that's – I treat it as a knock here because it is the Twilight Zone pinball machine. So as the theme works for that IP, I feel like it doesn't. On the other hand, because again, and then you touched on earlier, the power, the gumball machine, those are things that are big features that actually have nothing to do with the Twilight Zone. So from that point of view, like some of your main draws aren't even relevant to the IP that you're trying to sell. And so it's, you know, certain way, it's like it's a really cool pinball machine with a Twilight Zone skin on top, and that skin does nothing for me.
That's a very good point. And in my case, I viewed that almost as like a positive. Like I appreciated that there was like lip service to the things you needed to have in a Twilight Zone machine, like a little spiral effect for, you know, some sort of like
the
Twilight
door.
Zone mystery. Yeah, doors and the Twilight Zone music. But then the things that I liked thematically about the machine were the things that were unique.
Yeah.
Not related to the Twilight Zone. So like the ceramic ball, the gumball machine,
the power
magnetic battle and so forth. So that was okay for me, I felt like. I felt like it did a good job of like still being a Twilight Zone machine, but not like forcing it.
Yeah, and it's funny because I think we're saying the same thing. It's just in the case of how I want to rate it on theme, like this would be a high rated theme for me if it was a unique IP. Like at that, and probably in the 90s you wanted the IP because you could hook people on like, oh, I know the Twilight Zone, I'll play that. But like this is maybe more of a, I'm knocking it because I love the execution. I just like put something unique on it. Like this is not a Twilight Zone machine.
Yeah, I think that was my one sort of negative point for the theme was that all the tie-ins that it did have, I guess they had to be there, they didn't feel particularly connected to the game, which was a great game.
Yeah.
But like the camera shot. Why was it a camera? What did that mean? Like, yeah. What is a? It could have been anything.
Yeah,
it could
yeah,
have
yeah.
Been any shot. Yeah. So, you know, there's what, like a camera, there were like hitchhikers,
robots.
Yeah, robot shots. Like, and like, yeah, we get it. There are references to the Twilight Zone, but like, it didn't seem like they had any connection to the mechanics.
Yeah,
they
it were doesn't elevate to. The gameplay.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was my only knock. I still gave it a 4 out of 5 because I really liked everything about it.
Yeah, I think this is the first time I've ever rated this category and sort of wished I had like a subcategory almost of. Because I want to say, like, the theme for me is a 2 out of 5 if I'm judging it as a Twilight Zone theme.
Oh.
On the other hand, I think as, like, a weird hodgepodge of just stuff, like, it's awesome. Like, it's a really cool, engaging world that it's put me in, but none of the world that I'm engaged with is Twilight Zone.
And so for you, that matters enough that you gave it a lower score, or
I think it's just that's the way I'm viewing theme, right? Like I'm judging it as a theme of a Twilight Zone machine, mm-hmm. and like it doesn't hit that mark on that. On the other hand, it does. Like it is excellently executed. If it was themed anything else,
all basically. Right. Well, you gotta commit then. What is your score?
It's a 2 out of 5.
Okay.
I want it on the like an asterisk there that someone says like. It's not because the theme is poorly like it's only poor in the lens of Twilight Zone. Like yeah. It's
I'm going to go ahead and just like amend the bylaws of the podcast right now in real time and say that if you want to make that your rubric for theme for this episode, you do it. But I'll give you to the end of the episode to decide. I don't want to put you on the spot.
Yeah, that's
tough. I mean this is going down in history, Mark, as
well. Here's the challenge that I'm facing, Drew, is because at some point I want us to do like a retrospective where we go and we start saying, you know, machines that have a certain threshold of scores that we rated are like in the pantheon of all-time greats.
Yeah.
And a score like that hurts the Twilight Zone, but like my gut check is Twilight Zone, from my experience playing it, probably belongs there. Like it's unique and it's engaging and like it executes well. I don't know. Like that's where I'm a little bit torn.
We're going to get a little meta here talking about why we have these categories. The categories are not to, you know, we talked about this before we started recording any episodes. The categories are not to like be the definitive score of a game, but rather to drive conversation about it. And I think we've had a great conversation about it. And so now it's a question of whether you're going to let the tail wag the dog and keep the Twilight Zone out of our best of episode.
Yeah, right. Well,
anyway, we'll get back
we'll come
to that.
Back to it.
So getting on to fun. This one, once again, is sort of a catch-all for whatever maybe we haven't covered. I think we've pretty much covered it. I really enjoyed all the unique kind of campy things about this game, even though the theme maybe didn't apply, you know, great in terms of like connecting the IP of the Twilight Zone to the mechanics of the game. I still, you know, liked hearing the theme music. I liked seeing the little animation for the hitchhiker on the screen.
Yeah.
All of it was just great. And I had one really good game where it felt like in the late game when I had kind of achieve some of the objectives, the points really were just like pouring in.
Yep.
Which is something that happens, I think, a lot of times in pinball. Where
did you get the clock tower big point objective? Because that one was it was like almost unfair. I think there's like the in between the gumball machine and like the left ramp, there's just like a center side target. And when you get clock tower mode, you just hit that. And every time you hit it, I think it was 5 million, 10 million, 15, 30.
It just keeps going up.
Uh huh. And like it's, I think I got it to 35. Like,
oh, I don't think I even unlocked that mode.
It was insane. It was like obvious my best game too, because I think some of the objectives and modes as it keeps going just pour it out.
I didn't, but I think on my best game I did get like 2 extra balls, which meant that like a lot of the objectives that I had finished, you know, almost like compounded the points. And I don't even remember what the big points were, but I just remember seeing, you know, 10 million here, 15 million there, just like really pouring in, and that was really satisfying. My only knock on the fun is that occasionally it felt a little random, but I think that's not even a con, that like
that's just pinball, I think.
Yeah, a game, I meant the scoring, like,
oh,
right? Like,
sure.
A little bit of randomness is okay, I think, and I don't think it was overbearing. So for me, I gave this a 5 out of 5 on fun. I had a blast. I'd love to play it again.
I'm actually going to amend this score here on the fly. Originally, I gave it a 3 out of 5, but I'm going to bump it up to a 4 for sure, because I think there was just a lot that I keep coming back to and thinking about that was engaging. But originally when I first reviewed this, I was really hung up on, I think, the stuff that took away from the fun for me. And like, for me, that's the fact that that Magna Flip situation when you're battling the power is, it didn't age well for a machine that's now 30 years old. Yeah. I felt like it was a bit overrated. I lost at least two balls to having to tilt the machine to get it out.
And that could really affect your game, I'm sure.
It was a little frustrating. I also had like an extra ball, like, you know, a couple of times where I felt like right out of the launch, like I hit a slingshot or something, it just like auto drained. And there was the shortest ball save, which is an improvement for Pat Lawler of this time because Adam's family didn't have one.
I had to ask you the first time I drained, like really quick. I was like, is there a ball save on this? Yeah. And you said, yeah, it's really, really fast.
I got it once out of like—
I ended up later getting one, but yeah, I had some early drains
too. Seven games, I think, that I played, like the four investigation games and three competition. So like that, at the time, really detracted from some of the fun for me. But on the other hand, I go back to a lot of the stuff that you've touched, like the interesting variety of shots, the gumball shots, the clock tower shot for me was super satisfying because it was like also I was just dialed in to like – normally I get frustrated if I can't hit like either lane, and like just finally being able to split the difference to pay out for me was really, really nice. And it felt like a real treat when you got to the different objectives and you could see the points really rack up. Lastly, I like the Powerball, the kind of white ceramic ball, kind of a cool idea, but like in practice, what did it do? Right? Like that didn't do anything.
Yeah,
for me.
I saw the rules there that there was
like
some
load
sort of
the
mode.
Gumball machine, I think. Like you want, I think it does a payoff if you put the Powerball in the gumball machine after you've like lit it all up or whatever. And I didn't get that payoff. And I think maybe there's something kind of cool about it's a 1 in 5 or 1 in 6 chance to get that ball. And so like there's a chance for like a really big payout if you get it and then you accomplish the objectives and hit that shot. And that's kind of neat. But in a practical sense, you didn't see the Powerball all that often.
Yeah, I ended up only playing 3 total games, and I saw the Powerball one time in those 3 games.
Yeah. So I'm gonna give it a 4 out of 5. I'm gonna bump it up 1 point. And I'm gonna go back to the theme, and I'm going to give it a 4 because I think that's appropriate. I really loved the execution of the way it did things. It made me feel like I was part of a world, even if that world was not Twilight Zone specifically.
Yeah, I think – and that seems appropriate because the more I think back to playing the Twilight Zone, the more I like it. And I feel like, you know, just talking about it here makes me like it even more than I did at the time. And hopefully
That's how I'm feeling.
Have those same experiences. So let's talk scores then. I hate to do this to you, but like you played a few games and I played 3 games. And I it was one of those where I just felt kind of into it. And on my first game, I scored 305 million, wow. 286, 350.
That's great. On my second game, I had my highest score and I felt great because I smashed through like the replay score, which is always like a good benchmark for me. Like if I'm having a good game to get a free game, then I'm doing pretty well. I got 168 million, 352, 660. And I thought that was great. And then, you came in and you just knocked it out of the park.
Yeah. And it's very strange because I usually take a while to warm up to a machine, but for whatever reason, on my very first game playing this machine after who knows how many months or years of not playing it, I just had my best game, and that's great. I don't know. Maybe in the future, Mark, you'll get a chance to practice if only there was any time.